Welcome to Prefer Not To, a weekly sometime cocktail hour.
Always cocktail hour.
With your hosts, Josh and Kate. I'm not Kate.
I'm not Josh.
Where we have a cocktail each week and proceed to talk about movies and television and whatever other cultural flotsam floats through our transom.
Falderall
even. Mm-hmm. Flotsam Transom. That's, wow. That's like an indie band name. Flotsam. I can't do that.
It's so obscure you can't even pronounce it.
Flotsam Transom.
Good job.
That's good. Yeah. I had an apartment with the transom. It was a little tiny. It wasn't even really an apartment. It was more like it was sort of a hostel where I stayed for a summer, and it was incredibly hot, and I was up on the 13th floor. It was the summer of 96 in Chicago, where there were like 600 old people died from the heat.
I remember it being a hot summer, but this was, of course, in North Carolina.
Right. And there were national pledge drives to buy old people window air conditioning units, and I would walk out on the street, and it was so hot that my Chuck Taylors would start melting.
Oh my
on
God.
The pavement.
Really?
Yep.
Oh,
it was
wow.
That hot. And the only cooling that I had in this little hostel was this transom and a little window fan to move the air, and I was so sweaty.
So let me ask you, how many eggs did you cook that summer?
You know, I think at one point, my friend Seth and I were going to try and cook an egg on the sidewalk just because we had heard people
right.
do it. And, you know, every time it's that hot, the local news will do that. They'll go out and cook an egg, you know, or do engine block eggs, which anybody can do. But
so it didn't happen.
No, it did not happen. Okay. I failed Yodagoon. So what cocktail are we enjoying this week, Kate?
This week we are having a dark and stormy.
And what's in a dark and stormy?
A dark and stormy is ginger beer, rum, and a garnish of lime. The rum in question has to be dark rum. This is, again, like most cocktails, as we've come to discover, are very contested in what goes in them and where they came from and why.
So give us the breakdown of the ingredients.
The official ingredients here are Gosling's Black Seal rum and Gosling's premium ginger beer. As you can imagine, it was invented by a man named Gosling.
Do they have a goose on the label? I bet they do, don't they?
No, it's actually a black seal because of...
Oh, because of this beverage?
Yeah, and we're about to go into the history about that.
Tell us.
So this is a beverage that has become popular in the United States through maritime and Navy workers, as, again, a lot of cocktails seem to do, mm-hmm. along the East Coast and your Newports and your Portland, Maines, and whatnot. So it was originally invented... Well, let me go back. So in 1800, a man named James Gosling sailed from Britain with the intention of getting to America. However, he stopped in Bermuda, and I guess he liked it, so he decided to stay there. And in 1823, he opened up his store with his brother, and they worked on developing different kinds of rum and other tropical liqueurs. In 1863, they developed what it was called Old Rum, which was a very dark rum instead of, mm-hmm. you know, your gold rums and your white rums like Bacardi tends to do. This is a dark...
Well, Bacardi will do all. I mean, they make something like a third of the world's rum, I think.
Right, but they were more famous for developing other kinds of rum. This is like your classic dark rum.
Well, isn't it just how much you filter out the leftover molasses? It's all molasses, right?
Yeah, I believe in cane, but I believe so. It's just that was their shtick and they stuck to it. So they started serving it, and as you can imagine, the British soldiers and Navy men really liked it. They had to sell it in old champagne bottles, which were apparently the only vessel that was most popular at the time, were just like surplus champagne bottles, which, and here's the kicker, came with a black seal. So they started asking for black seal.
So it's a homophone type thing.
Yeah, with the seal, and then eventually they repatented it as a black seal rum. Instead of old rum, and now the bottle has a black seal on it.
Well, that's crafty. It does taste very maritime. It's like a punch almost. You know, we could actually go into punches. You know, punches were huge, like in the 18th and 19th century. Now, almost no one drinks punches.
I've looked at Planter's Punch a couple of times, but it seemed a little complicated.
Well, yeah, and you have to make a big bowl of them, which I think is one of the reasons why they sort of fell out of fashion, is that people stopped hosting big party balls and instead small cocktail parties.
Well, here's the interesting thing about Black Seal is that apparently it's won a platinum medal in the World Spirits Championship, which I just have to wonder, what is that championship like? Do all like the, you know,
well,
like
they have
like
wine competitions. Why wouldn't they have liquor competitions?
Just think about it. Do you not imagine just like a grizzled old men like competing against each other and drinking?
Oh, at drinking them? I don't think it's a competition for drinking them any more than like, you know, the wine connoisseur ratings is how winey They are.
I just thought it was an interesting
idea. It is. I think there are competitions for liquor drinking. I think we saw that documentary a few months ago, Raiders of the Lost Ark,
mm-hmm.
about the liquor drinking competition.
Oh, yeah, but that was vodka, right?
Right. So the Dark and Stormy is purely a creation of this rum company.
They've patented it. I mean, they make it. Mm. There's a bunch of different ways that
you can make
it. So are we violating
copyright law by doing this?
Slightly. They've patented it, so the official Dark and Stormy is with Gosling Materials. However, you can make it with Shock, Jamaican rum, and Jamaican ginger beer, which ours is a little bit of both. We have Jamaican ginger beer and Gosling's rum in mm-hmm. ours today because there was no other option.
So we're not having a licensed Dark and Stormy. We're having a grim and overcast.
Exactly.
All right. Well, fair enough.
A sad and foreboding forecast.
a gloomy and low pressure cell. I don't know where I was going with that.
Oh wow, that is tasty.
It's very like a punch though, because mm-hmm. the ginger beer is already not terribly carbonated.
Yeah,
but it is sweet.
It's extremely drinkable.
It is very drinkable. Hey, have any dreams this week?
Actually, I really didn't. It was a low week for Kate and dreams.
Are you sleeping okay?
I'm sleeping fine. It's just they're really boring and routine. I had more dreams about work. I had dreams about, nothing interesting. No Prince.
Speaking of Prince, did you see that thing that I sent you about the new Prince single?
You're lying. That has to be a joke.
It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true.
No.
It's true. It's the cover of, supposedly the cover of the new Prince single has a photo still of Dave Chappelle doing Prince from one of his Prince skits.
There was only the one, but it's classic television.
Indeed it is. So I thought that was cute. I thought you're going to have a dream now about Dave Chappelle and Prince?
I really hope not.
And Charlie Murphy. Oh God, we've already come back to Eddie Murphy.
We're trying.
We're circling. Kate and I realized earlier today that we talk way too much about three or four different topics, one of which is Eddie Murphy.
The other is probably Planet of the Apes and Kevin Costner.
Yeah, and Eddie Murphy. Prince. We hit Prince a lot.
Yep.
So, and Kids Bob.
But honestly, can you blame us? They're all very endlessly fascinating topics.
As is apparently the Dark and Stormy. Did you see how I brought that back full circle?
I did.
So do you like it? You tasting it?
I did.
I made the mistake. My lime dropped off into mine before I got to squeeze it. So I don't think I'm getting the full lime effect. I'm not going to fish it out because I'm a gentleman.
The lime is it's served with a lime garnish. And again, that is optional. So some people will either squeeze it in or just have it. Or you drink it with just the rum and the ginger beer. I like it with the lime.
I like the lime to cut the sweetness. Yeah.
Exactly.
It does take it a little toward the tequila drink end of the spectrum. But it's not bad.
I think you mean the tequila.
Right. The word that Kate still has huge difficulties pronouncing.
This is interesting. Ever since our California Dream podcast, when we actually had tequila, I've had the hardest time pronouncing the word.
So it was only since the California Dreams?
Yes. Ever since then, I always, my go-to is to pronounce it tequila, which is just so Southern.
I wonder if maybe there was something in the California Dream, because it was not a pleasant drink.
You mean aside from
California Dream?
And in despair and...
It was like maybe a heavy metal or something that went to a really specific part of your brain, the part that can pronounce tequila.
I did get a really off-brand brand of tequila. See, I have to actually think about it every time I say it.
So that's the Dark and Stormy. As always, we welcome cocktail suggestions.
And Sarah, I promise we're going to do a Mai Tai at some point, but right now it's just too complicated.
I think maybe in the depths of winter, when we're longing for the sun beaming down on us and Polynesian sensations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a possibility. It's been very, very rainy of late here. So Dark and Stormy is appropriate, don't you think?
I do, especially on this gloomy Monday afternoon.
It is gloomy. Hey, speaking of gloomy, Breaking Bad started back up.
It did.
What are you thinking of the season so far? Let me give an advance warning that, you know, we will be talking about the first two episodes of Breaking Bad, which are all the first two of the second half of this, because of AMC, the way that they stupid do seasons. The two most recent episodes.
I'm just curious, do you know how many episodes are supposed to be in this half season? Like five or six?
I think it's eight.
Oh, okay.
I think it's eight more episodes.
You mean six more episodes.
Well, right. And now that we've had the first two. So what are you thinking of it? What are you liking? What are you not liking? What's confusing you?
I'm very interested in it. I like the direction they're going with the plot and the confrontation between Hank and Walt. I kind of wonder how they're going to pace it out, because if it does in fact have to last for six more episodes, something's going to break sooner rather than later.
Really? I think if anything, it feels a little too rushed because, you know, they've had 4.5 years.
That's what I'm saying, is it's now that it's happened, it would happen to, like, as in, it would be a catalyst, and mm-hmm. they're not going to be able to flush it out. right. for the remaining six
right.
episodes.
Right, it does feel like maybe they didn't know exactly what they were going to do, and now they realize they only have eight episodes. But, you know, I have faith in Vince Gilligan, too.
I just think it's very interesting when... And first, I realized this earlier today, the show itself has only taken place over about 3 years, or as far as we know, yet all these things have happened and all these developments have happened to these people. It was just interesting, the fact that this is, again, going so quickly.
Right.
But the show is really good at making you think that it's been a while, mm-hmm. and doing the plot details and everything in greater detail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like that. I like the conflict between Hank and Walt. As you remember, because you caught me up to this is another one of those shows that you caught me up to speed on before season four.
Yes.
And, you know, my big problem with the first season was how Hank was such a buffoon and such a cartoonish character. And I didn't think he sort of worked as a foil for Walt. And I like that they've sort of gotten rid of that buffoonish bit of his personality.
Well, Walt was kind of a doof in the first season, too. I mean,
right. The first season was very broad. Every time people start watching it, I'm like, you know, the first season is kind of hit or miss. Stick with it is what I tell them.
Yeah, well, the first season's okay. The characters aren't really as drawn out as well as they could mm-hmm. be. And then you get to the scene where they melt through a bathtub and you're kind of hooked, which is what happened to me. I was like, oh, God.
Right. I think, and also because so much of the first few seasons, especially, or like seasons 2 and 3, focuses on Walt and Jesse. The fact that they hadn't really planned to have Jesse be a major character until they were shooting season 1 and sort of decided, oh, hey, look, this is a good dynamic. I think that's reflected in the tone of the first season being a little different from the later shows.
Well, in the second season, too, they suffer with the whole idea that Walt is the only person that knows that he's a meth, you know, maker, and he has to make all these excuses to his family. There's that gambling subplot.
Right. And there is a sort of element of the wacky farce of we're hiding, you know, will he get caught this week?
When Skyler confronts Jesse at his house and says, like, you know, stop selling my husband pot, and mm-hmm. it's like all of that followed. I think it became a lot more real and the characters are a lot better drawn.
Mm-hmm.
When everybody knows what's going on.
Well, there's that. There's the getting rid of the sort of farcical element of it. There's taking the tone back a bit from the broadness of the first season, which I think was a little broad, and it was a little too focused on, hey, he's a high school teacher, but he's also doing meth, selling meth.
He's got cancer.
Right. So pulling it back from the broadness, that's one thing. But and getting rid of the farcicalness. But then also having a foil for Walt in the form of Gus Fring for seasons 3 and 4, I guess. Or just 4? No, 3 and
he
4.
He got blown up at the end of 3.
4, I thought. Yeah, he got blown up at the end of 4.
What happened in season 3 then?
Season 3 was when he killed Gale at the end of season
3. Oh, okay.
Jesse killed Gale at the end of season 3. So, yeah, I think having an adequate foil for him for seasons 3 and 4 worked. And then I think the tone changed. But yeah, I'm liking season 8 a lot. I'm a little confused as to what, and I have been since they brought her on at the beginning of season 5, the role of Lydia. I don't understand the purpose of her character. I don't understand the whole connection to this European conglomerate that was tied into Los Pollos Hermanos.
Well, the idea is that Gus Fring had to have a way to distribute, like he couldn't just control the lower...
No, I understand it plot-wise. It just seems to go a little bit... It seems to be going a little bit far afield from our core conflict, which is Walter White.
And I don't think so.
I hope they bring it back together. I mean, that's literally... If I were having complaints, it's... I still don't understand why that's necessary for storytelling. And... Also, the second episode, we had almost no Jesse, except for the very opening cold open.
That's one of my complaints, is that Jesse has been kind of absent, and also, well, it's obvious that he's having some issues dealing with what he has
done.
Right,
but that's interesting. I find that interesting. And
right.
For them to sort of tease it and then not go into it is not really fair to us.
Right. I mean, in the first season, I mean, the first episode of this half season, all you get is him wanting to give his money away. There is that really great scene with him and Walt, where he accuses Walt of killing Mike. Even if he doesn't say it.
You mean going on vacation to Belize.
Yeah, exactly. Which was really well done. But then he, you know, gets high and decides to give all of his money away and crash into a playground. I don't know. I think Aaron Paul has so much more in him.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that they do something.
Oh, hey, you know what we're going to be watching? We'll probably watch this tonight. We're going to watch that Smashed movie with him and, what's her name? The girl from all those horrible movies, but she's really cute and funny. You know, the one where they're married. No, where they're a married couple and they're trying to quit
drinking.
What
else has she been in?
Oh, God. She was in one of the Final Destinations, I think. Hold on. Yeah, it is Mary Elizabeth Winstead. I wanted to say Mary Elizabeth Winstead, and I forgot.
Who is she?
She's an actress. She's in a lot of little things, and everything. Every time she's in something, you're like, this girl could be in something so much better. And apparently this was a tour de force performance. We're talking about something we haven't seen. But it's with Aaron Paul and her, and it's a comedy about a married couple trying to quit drinking.
I'd say we could watch it. Well, that sounds... I don't know if that works for us, because, I mean... You're just going to make us sad about drinking.
No, that can make me sad about drinking. And you know what? I get drinks. So it fixes that problem. So far, so good on Breaking Bad.
Yeah,
this
is right. I think, have we talked about Skylar White before on the podcast?
We have not actually talked about Skylar White.
This is
going to
be a whole delving down into a rabbit hole for me. Like many things, Josh and I are against the internet on this one.
I don't think so. I think there is a large portion of the internet that is pro Skylar White. I think it's just... There's a certain element of Breaking Bad fandom that finds her loathsome. And, you know, we have the virtue of being on the side of the show's author. I just don't get the hatred for Skylar White. I think, you know, she's a pretty consistent character who is smart, if a little shrill, but, you know, whatever. And again, you have to sort of take out the first season where she's sort of painted as this suburban killjoy. Again, that's part of what I talk about, this first season being so broad and tonally different. Like, she's this sort of dim suburban killjoy. Hank is a doofus cop who bottles his own beer. It's like, it's very broad. But if you take away the first season, you know, she's really someone who is what Walt thinks that he is, which is someone who puts the interest of her family first.
I think it's a problem with a lot of modern TV shows. Anytime you have where your main character is this tortured white man who is facing his own demons even as he creates them, you have the wife or the love interest who is almost universally seen as a killjoy. You have this with Carmella in The Sopranos. You have it with Betty Draper in Mad Men, and you also have it even in The Walking Dead. Like, Lori is held up as someone who is bad because she is shrill.
Hey, I forget, did Carmella ever fuck Furio?
I don't think so. I think they made out, and then he was like...
Because I wanted that shit to happen.
Oh, me
so
too.
Bad.
But she's derided as shrill and annoying, and then the second that they stray from the marriage, they're automatically like...
I think what it is, and I think you're close on it, I think it's... These characters are viewed as an impediment to why a lot of people, a lot of male viewers, are viewing the show, which is as this sort of disempowered white male wish fulfillment fantasy, where, you know, I feel weak in the world, and I'm a nerd, or, you know, I'm not strong, but if I could be like Walter White, and I'm, you know, because Walter White is essentially Ender Wiggin. In that his brains turn him into a Superman, and everyone's jealous of how good he is at what he does.
You know what I just thought of?
What?
We should have a part of the podcast, like a new segment called Unpopular Opinions.
That's the whole damn show.
Where I was just thinking that we can talk about how much Ender's Game is awful.
Well, settle down.
I can't. I'm chomping at the bit.
But what I'm saying is, I think ultimately the reason that a lot of people who... like Breaking Bad, don't like Skylar White, is that her character interferes with their wish fulfillment. They don't view Walter White as a villain. They don't view him as an anti-hero. They view him as someone like them who is doing whatever he has to make it, and isn't he badass? And it, you know, and again, that comes back to a pet topic of Josh's, which is the, you know, everything's got to be cool.
In about 5 seconds, dear listeners, he's going to mention Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, the fact that you mentioned it obviates my mentioning it. But instead of, I think it's an appropriation of the word anti-hero that isn't what it is. You know, they were wanting to turn anti-heroes into legitimate heroes.
Well, that's been a trend on TV for a while now. That's what I mentioned, Don Draper. I mentioned Tony Soprano.
Right. It's you know, Tony Soprano is not a good person. You're not. But there were a lot of people who convinced themselves that he was because they want to be able to kill people who they don't like at work.
Well, or just the idea, I don't want to go that broad. I want to say that just the idea that because he's the focus of the TV show, he's naturally the protagonist.
Well, he is. I mean, he is. He has, you know, the opportunity to change. And... But it is the Greek tragedization of television, which is, it is not a story of redemption, despite the fact that a lot of people like to throw that term around. It is, in fact, the story of people brought low by their flaws. You know, in Walter White's case, it's his overweening pride.
Yep. He thinks he's smarter than he is. He thinks he's more accomplished than he is.
And he thinks that, therefore, because he's smarter than everyone else, that anything he does is justified.
Including wearing those wallabies. I partially agree with you, Josh, but again, for me, a lot of this is tied into a lot of direct sexism when
right.
it comes to
well,
female.
That's what, right, and that's what I was getting to that, which is, I think it comes, the reason that they focus so hard on Skylar White is that in their own lives, part of what they want their wish fulfillment to overcome is their frustration with women. So because they identify with Walter White as someone like them who overcame whatever he's overcoming, being poor, living within the law, whatever it is that people who identify with Walter White want to be like him, but they also identify Skylar White with women who reject them. It's part of the sort of inherent, and we've talked about this before, the sort of inherent sexism of fanboy culture.
Well, I was going to go a different route. I was just, well, and this might tie in or it might not, but anytime, this is a constant pet peeve of mine, so just forgive me a little bit while I go off. The idea that if you are married to, like, this is a conceit that happens a lot. You're married to this horrible man who cheats on you, who kills people, who drinks, who abuses, who cooks meth. And the second that you fail to be his adoring wife and you cheat on him, which Carmella, Betty Draper, and Lori Grimes all have done, and Skylar White, that's when they get really pissed
right.
off.
Right. It's well, and it's the identity of sexual fidelity with supporting, you know, if you are not sexually faithful, then you are not supporting my desire to become better in life.
And Don Draper has been sleeping with women since the very first episode who weren't his wife. And the second that she has sex with that stranger in the bar.
Mm-hmm. That Peggy Draper, I mean,
Betty.
Betty Draper has sex with that
guy. Did I say Peggy
No, you
Draper?
Said Don Draper has been, yeah.
I'm
no,
saying
I
Don
was
Draper
wrong.
Has been, okay, right. All right, sorry. So Betty Draper, the second that happens right. is when people are like, well, she cheated on Don. She sucks.
Right.
Or the infamous Breaking Bad episode, IFT, aka
right.
I Fucked Ted,
right.
which was wonderful.
Right. That people who go to any absurd length of circumlocution and crazy, insane logic to justify the actions of Walter White will suddenly place what Skylar White did in cheating on her husband as the ultimate unforgivable sin is just absolutely backward. Skylar White never killed 10 people in the span of 10 minutes. You know, Skylar White didn't sell meth to kids. You know, Skylar White cheated on her husband, which is, you know, not necessarily a good thing, but also something that happens all the time and is well within the realm of sins, and also, by the way, not illegal.
I just think it's the idea that she's the only rational voice against the idea that her husband is selling meth and creating all this danger for their family. She's the only reasonable voice in this thing, and yet somehow she is the bitch.
Right. And again, I think it is, I really do, and I don't want to tread over this ground too much, but I really do think it's because they view her as sort of killing their wish fulfillment, that she's the killjoy. You know, she's the one who says, hey, you shouldn't be doing this thing. It punctures their little tortured justification, fan wanking for why Walter White is actually a good person. Also,
right.
also, I don't think it's a coincidence that Heisenberg wears a nice guys of OK Cupid hat.
I don't either, especially with this little like, yeah, no, I don't either. And Walt's fixation on the hat. Have you noticed that? Like, even if he's not wearing it, he'll still like finger it sometimes and caress it lovingly. And then yeah. when he puts it on, it's like he immediately goes into bed.
I mean, I'm being a little bit hyperbolic, but it is a convenient reminder to me of, and you know, I think the element of the hat that is badassery is part of what is people identify with him. The nice guy culture.
Well, I do like how he can be so, and this is something that speaks more to Bryan Cranston's performance than anything, how he can go from being like bumbling teacher to cold villain so quickly.
Oh, in the garage with Hank in the first episode.
Yeah,
it's
or
crazy.
The time where he catches some people buying meth materials at like the Walmart or whatever, and then in the parking lot just says, no, you're on my turf. Like, fuck off.
Right, and he went and put the hat on so they recognized him. Wasn't that it?
I don't remember, but I'm in.
Yeah. So anyhow, hey, last week it was leave Amanda Bynes alone. This week, leave Skylar White alone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dark and Stormy still okay?
Yeah,
yeah, we killed off that first round.
It's very like it's very refreshing and it's easy to drink, and yet it is not too overly alcoholic.
Yeah, it's not cloying and sweet, but it's also not super bitter. It's the kind of sweet punch type drink that you could serve without necessarily, you could serve to anyone.
I think Josh is subtly asking me to come up with a punch recipe for next week.
No, but I wouldn't mind. I mean, I read there was a book review of someone last year came out with a book of old punches that are totally antiquated now that no one's served since like 1840 or something. It
really?
Seems interesting. Yeah.
Because
I think a part of it is a lot of it is you can't get these liquors anymore.
Right. Like your elderberry.
Whatever. Yeah. Shit that Bert Cooper drinks.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because I have this book that I consult. It's called Old Man Drinks. And a lot of them, I'm like, I've never heard of you before. Or I look at you and I'm like, what the shit is that?
Right. Or you can't tell whether they're a cocktail or some sort of 19th century disease. Like rusty nail, that's a cocktail. Tetanus, that's a disease. But, you know, if you had something like...
But if you stepped on a rusty nail...
Wouldn't you know it? The galloping corkscrew. That could be an affliction or a beverage.
I was asking my friend Shelby recently... Hi, Shelby. What cocktail we should do? And she said, well, my dad's favorite is the rusty nail. And I looked it up and I was like, oh my God, what is wrong with your father?
Hey, speaking of things wrong with parents.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is driving me crazy lately. And first of all, let me say, I love my mother. My mother is a saint.
She's a nice lady.
She's wonderful. However, my mom got a smartphone 3-4 years ago, like everybody else's mom. And she didn't text message before she had the phone. But once she got the phone, she started doing texting all the time. And she uses, like, the 14-year-old text abbreviations, like U for U, like the letter U for U.
The number four.
Or the number four, or the number two, or, like, B4 for before. And it's just deeply jarring to me. And it's like, I want to tell her, you know, they're not charging you by the fucking letter, Ma. But also, like, my mom, you know how my mom is. She'll just get all passive. Go, I guess I should never text you. I don't do it right.
She doesn't sound like Marge Gunderson there. Can you?
No,
that?
She sounds like fucking Droopy Dog there.
I'm just saying, like, usually when you tell mom stories and you do your mom voice, it's like, okay, Josh, well, I just shouldn't text you then.
But seriously, she would do that. If I told her not to do it, instead of just being like, oh, yeah, you're right, it's kind of goofy. You know, I think she would say something like, oh, I don't know what she would say. Plus, you know, she's got like an iPhone 5 and it's got speech recognition and stuff, so why doesn't she just do that? I mean, that'd be much wackier to get the wacky speech recognition failures.
It's probably because she can't figure out how to work it.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I mean, my dad does the same thing too. He'll text me and he'll always, it's a lot less egregious mm-hmm. than your mother. He'll use the U for you, but that's pretty much it. Or he'll be very curt mm-hmm. and just say like, please text, or and use TXT for text and stuff like that, or all is okay, and he'll like, you know, or I'm trying to think, but my dad's a very curt person.
You know, the other thing that my parents do that is sort of runs counter to, you know how if you get a message from someone on the internet or in text and it ends with a period, then you know they're either being like passive aggressive or super serious. But my mom will just use periods because, like, that's grammar.
I do that because it's grammar.
Right, but, you know, sometimes it's like, you know, if I say, I need to talk to you, or I needed to talk to you, period. Like, the second one is more sensitive, is more serious.
I don't think so. I think that if you just use basic English and grammar rules, then it should read as it should read.
Well, and then when I get one from my mother, it's even weird because it's like, I need to, number two, talk to, the letter U. Period. So it's like, is it frivolous or is it serious? I don't know.
I think that you're overreading into this. I want to go ahead and say that when Josh and I text each other, we use all caps as a rule.
I find it useful because if you have it as a rule that you're texting in all caps, nobody can sort of second guess whether or not you're using typography to indicate something sort of passive aggressive about what you do. So if everything's in all caps, you've taken, it's like a mutually assured destruction kind of thing. Everything is off the table if you're typing. And Kate and I are both prone to overreading and overinterpreting people's messages. So I think at least for us, it's sort of a way of tying our hands so that we're not freaking out the other one as being passive aggressive.
Yeah, but when I get a text message, it's like, I need to talk to you. All I can think is, first of all, you're older than I am, and you're the type of person that's concerned that kids aren't being taught cursive anymore in school. And yet,
my mother has wonderful cursive. It's beautiful.
Yeah, she has great handwriting. And anyway, there's that, and no crap, you threw me off. But they'll still massacre the English language in text messages. And, you know, if you're going to do that, then you need to be Prince. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think Prince has license to do that. The other thing is my dad's not really that good at using his phone. So when we have dinner, you know, he'll ask me, can I do this with my phone? Can I do, you know, I want to be able to delete lots of email messages at once, or like something really easy that you can do
with
your phone.
Then he needs a Windows phone.
Stop. Kate is making reference to that commercial that acted as though it was some sort of divine revelation that Hotmail could now delete mails or something, or Outlook.
Yeah, Outlook can delete mails all at once.
Right.
What?
It's madness. But my dad, he'll say, you know, oh, wouldn't it be great if, why is this phone broken? I can't do this. And it's always something that is very easy to do. So then I'll try and show him how to do it. And then I'll hand him his phone. And in the second and a half between when the phone leaves my hand and when he is looking at the phone, he has in some way grazed the phone with his thumb and taken it to like a completely different screen or menu and then has no idea what's going on. And he'll be like this. The screen is complete. It doesn't, you got to show me again. Show me again.
It's like when you're showing your parents, I don't know if this happens to you, but you're showing your parents like a photo or something.
Mm-hmm.
And you, in the second you hand them the phone, it's gone dark. And they don't know how to...
Because it's gone to, like, power save mode?
Yeah, and they don't know. Even if it's not actually off, it's just in, like, the darker, like, kind of thing. They're like, oh, it's gone dark, Kate. I can't see it.
Yeah, and they do this thing where they, like, flail their hands around. It's like, I don't... What is it? I don't... And then they hold it, like, it's farther from their face.
Right. My dad...
If they look at it farther, it'll look different.
My dad does this thing where he puts his glasses on his nose and, like, looks down at it and, like, kind of has to look at it like that for whatever reason. It's something that you need to see in person.
And your dad still likes to use phones with the thumb keyboards, right? Like BlackBerries and stuff.
Yeah, he does. We had the original Droid, which had the slide-out pattern for the texting, which I thought at first was cool because I just had one. I had the Envy or whatever it was. And then I quickly adapted to just tapping on the screen, and he still does that. And I'm pretty sure on his new phone it happens as well. And when he uses things on his computer, phone, same thing. Mm. When he's using thing on the phone, he uses one finger and just violently taps at it, like, you know, like,
well,
instead
of
just...
I don't thumb tap, but I'm old.
Yeah, well,
no, but it you know why? It hurts my thumbs. Like, it's so small, and it's like I can't move, and then my thumbs get all crampy. I'd much rather just bang, 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 and I'm faster that way with just banging with my index finger.
Yeah, except you're faster and you're used to using that. My dad literally just has to go, I space, a, t, a. Like the restaurant. Like it takes him forever to, like...
My parents are also like, they won't let the autocorrect just do its job.
Yeah.
Like they feel like they have to go back and correct things instead of just typing things and letting the autocorrect sort of fill out what they're doing. Madness. Anyhow, how do we get on that? We gotta do screen time soon, don't we?
We do, but I think we should get our second round first.
Okay, let's go get our second round.
Ba-do-boo.
Bow. Okay, we're back with our second round of Dark and Stormy. Still tasty?
Still dark and or stormy.
They are. I like them. I like them a lot. We tend to like the sweeter cocktails, I've noticed.
Yes. Anything involving lime, I've also noticed.
Yeah, we are very big on lime. That's true.
It's interesting fact I forgot to mention before is that the proper spelling of this drink is not dark and stormy. It's dark and stormy.
Oh, like rock no roll.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha. Ham and grits. Ham and gravy.
Ham
grits
and
gravy.
Ham and
sausage and biscuits.
Chicken and biscuits. It's chicken and biscuits.
It's chicken and waffles.
Chicken and dumplings.
You're a dumpling. So this is the part of the show we call Screen Time, where Kate and I select a year of our lives, in this case, the year we were 12 years old, and watch the movie that was number one in America that week in our lives. So this week, as I said, we selected the year we were 12. My year was 1985. Your year was?
2000.
My movie was Back to the Future. What was yours, Kate?
The Cell.
Okay, and then we watch the movies. We talk about whether or not they held up. We talk about our memories of having seen them the first time. Or not at all, and so forth. So, Kate, you want to go first, or you want me to go first?
Let's see. I'll go first. My movie was the 2000 picture The Cell, starring Jennifer Lopez, Vince Vaughn, and Vincent D'Onofrio. It was a psychological thriller it was billed as. The plot being that there is the serial killer played by Vincent D'Onofrio, who
A stretch.
who has his last or his latest victim trapped somewhere and they don't know where she is. And right at that moment, when they happen to find him, he has gone into this weird coma because of some mysterious disease, you know, science or whatever. And they have to use this experimental treatment that Jennifer Lopez is a part of, where you can enter the mind of coma patients and find their psyches and learn their secrets, kind of, right? Like, it was like a weird dream, but not a dream situation.
Yeah, they entered the person's brain in some sort of unspecified state of consciousness.
Okay, so that's what the plot is. Any thoughts about it? I thought that it was very beautiful.
So, yeah, so in the process, Vincent D'Onofrio is a serial killer who has captured and mangled a series of women and turned them into some sort of living sex dolls. They capture Vincent D'Onofrio in the course of their investigation, but they realize that he has one person still in captivity and she has to go. Jennifer Lopez has to use this crazy new science to go into his mind and figure out where the killer is. Also, Vince Vaughn has to go in there for some reason or other.
Well, that was completely useless, and we'll talk about that in a second, I guess, maybe.
Okay, but so what did you think of them? I also should mention that this movie was directed by Tarsem Singh, who apparently likes to go by Tarsem now. So it was a visual feast, a feast for the senses. So Kate, some first impressions or some second impressions? When did you first see this movie? Do you even remember?
I want to say that I saw this movie on like USA or, you know, TNT.
Yeah, I think that was my first time too. It was about 5 years ago on USA or TNT.
Right, and I saw it very soon after it came out because I remember, I didn't remember that Vince Vaughn was in the movie at all. But I did remember that it was Jennifer Lopez looking very pretty with a lot of trippy imagery. I remember being a lot more affected by it when I was probably 12 or 13 than I was this time around. It is a beautiful movie. It is great scene design, it's great costume design, but the plot itself is a little thin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it's weird because it's, you know, Tarsem makes these beautiful, he also made The Fall, he made that Immortals movie, he made Mirror Mirror, makes movies that are beautiful to look at. Like I said, Feast for the Senses, incredibly staged, lots of different, you know, sort of film speeds that sort of slow and speed things down, intricately edited. Everything looks, you know, looks like a commercial or a music video in the best possible sense of the word, in which, you know, a commercial or a music video has so much attention to the imagery because it's 3.5 minutes or 30 seconds. So they invest a lot of time and energy into creating a striking image. And Tarsem Singh does that in movies that last 2 hours long, which is, you know, that is a craft in and of itself. The problem is that the story in this is sort of a very generic Silence of the Lambs plus 7 plot grafted onto these beautiful pictures. And it sort of got me thinking that, like what is the place for someone like Tarsem in movie making? Like, he makes these beautiful images, but narrative-wise, he's trying to graft this talent onto stories simply because he's got to make a narrative movie. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I was wondering, like, I feel like he would be better suited as, like, an art director or, like, something like that. Where...
But no, but I mean, I think that's selling him short. You know, he makes movies, you know, I'm not going to forget the images that are in this movie or that were in The Fall.
Well, I actually forgot the images that were in this movie. One of which includes Vincent D'Onofrio, balding and in a weird Pope-esque gold suit with, mm-hmm. like, albino skin.
Right, with weird kabuki makeup like Robert Blake in Lost Highway.
Right.
But my point is just, there should be a place for someone who makes these striking and beautiful images, even if it's not, I don't know. I'm glad that this movie got made, is what I'm saying, even though...
It was his first, by the way.
Right, it was his first, well, outside of music videos and commercials.
Well, no, but it was his first film. Like,
right, I want to know where he fits in making movies. Although, I think Mirror Mirror is probably the most successful as a movie of any of those stories. So maybe he's heading in the right direction. It's just, you know, I would hate to live in a world where people who made images that look like that could only make commercials or music videos.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think that he needs a tighter script to hew to than...
Yeah, but I think, you know, the problem is that a script isn't everything about directing a narrative movie.
Well, yeah,
there's pacing and editing, and some of that is just stuff he clearly has no sense for, like, you know, directing a scene with two actors talking to one another, because it was just sort of limp and wooden when, like, Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Lopez are sitting there on that bench for what seemed like 6 hours.
Well, that's my point, though, is that you can use a script that gives room and structure structure to the mm-hmm. kind of imagery that he produces. Something like you're going inside the unconscious human brain mm-hmm. is almost too wide because it gives him way too much to cover and to do, and it doesn't steal, he appropriates all this imagery from modern art, and it's pretty, but it doesn't make much sense. And
I don't even think it's not even that it doesn't make sense, it's just that it's like grafted to a plot. It's like if someone directed the world's most beautiful episode of the A-Team, you know, it's like you take this sort of potboiler but make it incredibly pretty.
Yeah, and again, like Josh said, it wanted so bad to be Silence of the Lambs. It has this creepy killer who kidnaps women and drowns them deliberately and then makes them into, like, and then he bleaches their skin to make them into, like, these weird living dolls and then gets rid of the body.
And has hooks in his back for some reason that I don't think is ever actually adequately explained.
They say that he likes to be suspended above the
body. Oh, right, because crazy people apparently like to float.
He has this weird, he has a bunch of hooks in his back that he apparently, and this is something that bothered me. How does he hook himself up to that thing?
Yeah, that's, I don't, I can't even scratch my back. I don't know how I get, you know, but that was the element of that wanted to be Seven with all of its sort of creepy, fetishistic metal objects.
Yeah, and the idea that there's a woman trapped somewhere they have to find,
right.
And they have to go inside the mind of a serial killer, whether it's Hannibal Lecter or it's Vincent D'Onofrio. I can't even tell you the character's name. He's just Vincent D'Onofrio in a really bad wig.
Yeah, I don't want to linger too long. I am glad that I saw this movie. I'm glad that I saw it in full. I'm not sure it's a super successful narrative movie, but it is really pretty to look at. And not in a way that's sort of emptily pretty, like a lot of movies are pretty to look at. It's, you know, there are images that will stay in your brain, like when you look at, you know, art.
Yeah, or when you see Vincent D'Onofrio in a weird gold Pope outfit and kabuki makeup disembowel Vince Vaughn. That was awesome.
Okay, so that was The Cell. I would be very surprised if there were a lot of people listening to the show who hadn't seen Back to the Future, which was the number one movie in America in 1985, which was the year that I was 12 years old. But capsule recap. Marty McFly is a high school student whose parents are somewhat losery, and who has sisters, a sister and brother, who have fallen afoul of the hard times in their hometown of Hill Valley. He has a friend, Doc Emmett Brown, who sends him back in time with his time machine after getting gunned down by Libyans because he purloined some plutonium from a nearby nuclear plant. Marty goes back in time to the 50s, meets his parents, but unexpectedly complicates their meeting, requiring him to arrange for them to meet again. He does so through a series of canards, and eventually his father and mother meet under better circumstances than they met originally. Marty comes back to the future. His family is rich and successful, and the man who tormented his father both in high school and in real life turns out to be waxing his car in a spate of divine comeuppance, and movie ends with us heading off to a potential sequel. So, Kate, what was the first time you saw Back to the Future? Do you remember?
No, I really don't. I've seen it so many times. It's just like one of those movies that I grew up with existing in my brain. Much like Aliens or Predator or The Terminator, which tells you a lot about my parents.
So I have sort of a standard rant about Back to the Future, which I gave to you last night and you were rolling your eyes hard.
I'm still rolling my eyes hard.
This movie is about what America was thinking in 1985. The central message of this movie is we have to go back in time because somewhere along the lines we fucked up between the 50s and here. And if we go back and fix things and become more like we are in the 50s, then we'll come back to the future and we'll all be Republicans and rich.
Except 1985 wasn't like a necessarily horrible year to be an American.
No, it wasn't. But you have to remember this movie was being made and conceived in 83-ish, 84, when we had just come out of the biggest recession since the Great Depression. So there was an element of, but also the whole ethos of Reaganomics, which we've talked about Ronald Reagan before, was the, you know, we've got to get back to America's glory. We've got to get back to the time when, you know, mom and dad hugged each other and we ate apple pie and played baseball in Norman Rockwell. And that's the central ethos of this movie, is something went wrong and we got to go back and fix it. Now, the other thing that's weird about this movie is that a white guy goes back in time and invents rock and roll and steals it from the black man, which I think is just criminal.
Well, if we're going to talk about some criminal things about the past in this movie as it's represented, one of them is that. It's the idea that this guy went back in time, invented rock and roll for Chuck Berry, and apparently no one remembers him. And then there's also, if we're going to talk about it, the idea that they meet Lorraine and George, George McFly. So Marty interrupts their initial meeting, which is when George fell out of a tree and got run over by her father's car, meaning that they had to take him in, and they met and they ate dinner together, and presumably they started dating, and then they went to the Under the Sea dance, everything like that. In this instance, Marty accidentally pushed George out of the way because, you know, it's his dad. He doesn't want to get hurt. And then he becomes the George McFly character in that. So he has to make his parents fall in love all over again and meet and click so that he and his parents will not be, so that he and his siblings, rather, will not, you know, die and never exist. Mm-hmm. The way that they make that happen, however, is that the premise is that Marty is going to take Lorraine to the prom, take advantage of her, i.e. try and rape her.
Well, make her believe, at least, that she's going to be raped. Because it's central, if she's going to believe that George is a hero for vanquishing Marty, then she has to believe that Marty is going to rape her.
Right, so he's going to take advantage of her in the convertible, or not the convertible, the car outside of the dance, and then George is going to swing in, rather conveniently, punch Marty, and then take Lorraine to the dance, and they'll fall in love. Which says a lot about, I guess...
I don't know, but the plot does hinge on a son trying to convince his mother that he's about to rape her.
Well, there's that, and I was going to say, how do they know that that's how Lorraine is going to react? Why wouldn't she just be like, thanks, George... and goes into the dance and meets somebody right. else. Like, it's very strange.
Thank you for protecting me. I'm still not obliged to become your wife.
Exactly, exactly. And the fact, maybe it works better because Marty is dragged out of the car
this
by
is, by the
Ben.
Way, this is a movie that I love and think is wonderful.
But... oh, God, I love it, too. It's yeah. wonderful. Like, you tell us, we were quoting the whole thing last night as we talked, and being like, you know, did you notice that? Did you do that? You know, save the clock tower? Like,
right. But there is a sort of a core problem, which I think actually sort of ties into something else that I wanted to talk to you about this movie, which is, I don't think that this movie would get made this way today at all. I think, here's why. I don't think it fits the sort of neat demographic chunks that Hollywood likes to slice movies up into. Like, it's not, if it were made today, there would be one of two paths that it could be on. It would be either an incredibly raunchy, R-rated filth comedy where Marty actually fucks his mom and maybe fucks his dad and they have a big, you know, and then there's a lot of drugs and it's crazy.
Whoa, whoa,
you know,
whoa,
like
whoa.
You know, like one of these raunch comedies that you know, whatever, that's like a crazy, extreme comedy.
Yeah, but you know what? In American Pie, Jason Biggs never fucked his own mom.
Right, I know, but that's also 15 years ago.
Oh, my God.
Did I just blow your age?
I'm rolling my eyes so hard
no, but
right
let
now.
Let me finish, okay? I'm exaggerating a little bit, but they would have either made it sort of an R-rated sex romp, or they would have totally bled it dry and made a really bloodless, bland family drama. Maybe even, like, instead of casting a teen actor as Marty, they would have cast, like, an older actor who had to go back and pretend that he was young or some shit like that. They would have totally made it like a bland... my point is there's only two chunks of the mass market comedy audience right now, which is either gross-out comedies or family comedies.
See, I would say that there is another one. There's like indie, wacky, plinky-plonky kind of comedies like you get from Judd Apatow.
Well, I think Judd Apatow is pretty firmly in the gross-outs, but he makes good gross-outs. He makes good, you know, gross-out sex stuff, usually. Sometimes it's, you know, but, and, you know, I think Judd Apatow gets a bad rap sometimes on that front. But
I love Judd Apatow. I'm just saying that there is a difference between something like American Pie, which is just gross and revolves around men trying to have sex, and then you get something like Knocked Up, which has that element to it, but is also has some pathos.
But my point is that this is a PG-rated, mass-market family comedy whose central plot element involves a son convincing his mother that she's going to get raped by him.
I think that the central plot element is that they have to send Marty back to the future.
Well, also, and let's not forget that his mom is portrayed as the most sexually aggressive person in the entire movie, which I think is something that, you know, movies have only recently gotten around to sort of addressing in female sexuality, which, again, it's just a very strange movie in terms of niche market. And, you know, if you read about the history of it, there were a lot of studio execs who wanted to sort of raunchy it up because that you may, and I'm not trying to be patronizing, but there was a previous golden age of filthy Hollywood sex comedies which was in the early 80s. It was the post-Porky's boom in titty comedies. And there were studio execs who wanted to push Back to the Future in that direction. But, you know, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I just don't think we would see a movie like this, a PG-rated movie about a guy whose mom wants to fuck him.
Except a lot of movies in the 80s, we didn't have the modern rating system.
Well, but, you know,
there was no PG-13.
That's true, but I would be very surprised if even PG-13, this movie, would be made in a PG-13 fashion today. I just think it was kind of a surprise it was made that way then. I mean, I think it's a testament to the power of Steven Spielberg, for one, and Bob Zemeckis and everybody else involved in the movie that it got to be made that way. But, you know, it's strange to me that I was watching it and I'm like, the other thing that struck me was, for a movie that the comedy of the movie relies so much on noticing anachronisms in the past, like, oh, it's crazy how they had, you know, they didn't have phone prefixes, or they didn't have Pepsi Free, which, you know, we don't have anymore anyway, about the 1950s segments of the movie. Watching it today, how many parts of the 1980s segments of the movie don't exist today? Like, you know, adult film theaters and newspapers and trucks that drive around talking about political candidates and malls.
The malls still exist.
Dude, superstores have killed almost all of the malls.
I'm just saying, you do get your malls where teenagers go to get their Orange Julius or whatever.
Oh, I love Orange Julius.
I would say that the sequel, the Back to the Future Part 2, is even weirder because it does, like, one of those things that I think is hilarious with movies where they predict the future and then you get to that point in time and it isn't what you expected. There's no jetpacks, there's no hoverboards.
Yeah, but I think the way it does it is so over the top that it doesn't seem like it's trying to be any sort of future verisimilitude.
Well, I mean, it's just, I know that it's over the top, but you get, do you never struck?
I think the funniest thing about Back to the Future Part 2 is that it uses newspapers to convey the effect that the past has changed or the present has changed. It's like, newspapers, really?
I just like that. I don't remember what is it in 1985, Back to the Future Part 2? Like, they start off in 85
and then
they go
year.
Forward.
It's like 2012 or something.
Well, they go forward to 2012 and it's like really weird that Jaws is being made
in 3D. 2015 or something.
You know how, like, he there's the, and it's like, oh no, 3D! 3D
well,
movies!
Well, part of that is, you know, there had already been a 3D Jaws at that point.
No, I did not.
Yeah, Jaws 3 was, the actual title was Jaws 3D. There was a big spate of 3D films. You know how 3D goes in cycles?
I know. I mean, Friday the 13th Part 4, right. I think, was
Nightmare,
in 3D.
Nightmare on Elm Street 3 was in 3D. I think Halloween 3 may have been in 3D, but it was a big spate in the early 80s of 3D movies. It goes in cycles, which is why I'm thoroughly confident that the current 3D bullshit is going to, which is fine for me because I can't watch that stuff. It gives me a headache because I'm an old man.
I just think that it's always funny where you see Star Trek episodes and they've got iPads and then people are like, oh my God, they have iPads. I don't know.
Except they're like twice as big as an iPad and
they're the same size.
No, but they're like thick. I mean, look at them, they're like an inch and a half thick. They're way thicker, Star Trek iPads.
No.
Okay, we gotta pick our movies for next week.
Okay. Here we go. 12.
No, we can't do 12 again. We did 12 this time.
Okay, let's head.
Wait, did we do 12? Yeah,
we did
12 this time. Okay.
It'd be a different week, maybe. But about 23.
23. Okay, so that would be 2011, 2010.
Mm.
Let's say 2010. Let's just 2010, and what would 23 be for me? 73, 83, 93, 96. We did 96 because that was
2008.
Jack.
2008. Was I really? Oh my God, I was. Jesus Christ, time.
Let's just pick a year. We're gonna do 1997 and 2010?
Let's see, I'm 24, or I'm 25 now, and it's 2013, so I would have been 23 2 years ago, which would be 2011.
So 96 in 2011?
Yep. I'm actually kind of scared right now.
Which one do you want to do first?
Let's do mine. See you for the week of August.
Third week. Oh, it's The Help.
No.
Yep, we're going to watch The Help.
I've never actually seen that movie.
Well, there you go, and you love Viola Davis.
I do, but not in weird blaxploitation, modern blaxploitation movies.
I don't think, I think it is not modern blaxploitation, but it is offensive, and it's offensive in plenty of new and fresh ways.
All right. Let's do Josh's.
1997? My wife says 1996.
86. Or 96. Whatever.
Oh, yes! Oh, wait, no, it's Tin Cup. Okay, so it's Kevin Costner vehicle, Tin Cup. I thought I got Island of Dr. Moreau, which would have been awesome.
We just make it
the
Island of Dr. Moreau
Chart says Kevin Costner and Rene Russo and Cheech Marin in Tin Cup. And Chart says, what was yours again?
Viola Davis. And Emma Stone in The Help. This will be interesting because I haven't seen either of these movies.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Tin Cup's actually a pleasant and inoffensive Ron Shelton sports movie.
Oh, okay. All right.
All right. So we'll be back with recommendations in just a minute. Okay, so we're back. A little bit of housekeeping before we go into recommendations. Wanted to thank everybody for listening to the show, who's listening. Wanted to ask again, go to the iTunes store and write us a review. We really welcome them. They mean a lot to us. If you listen to the show, if you like us a little bit, write a little review. Wanted to thank my friend Matthew, who did I thank him last week? I don't know, who wrote a review. My friend Adam, who also wrote a review. Wanted to thank your friend Jason, who posted after our discussion last week of Amanda Bynes, a wonderful little song by John Darnielle about don't be asshole to celebrities, which I thought was very cute, and I recommend everyone go to the site where he linked it from.
Which is pntcast.wordpress.com.
That is right, pntcast.wordpress.com. We're also on Twitter, @pntcast. You can email us, pntcast@gmail.com. And there's a Twitter, Tumblr, pntcast.tumblr.com. So that's a little bit of housekeeping. We're going to segue into our...
Sorry, one more thing. Again, seriously, if anybody has a drink that they want us to try, let us know.
Yep. Take 15 seconds, send us the name of a cocktail, and write us a little review, and you will have quite honestly made my week.
Other than that, we're just going to keep drinking lime and various liquors. Yeah,
various things that have booze, lime, and bubbles. So, we're going to go into recommendations. Kate, what are you going to recommend to folks this week?
I'm going to recommend a delightful little book. It's called Wreck This Journal by Carrie Smith. It's not actually a book. It is a journal that gives you suggestions about how you can tear it up and mess it up and make it your own. It's very
cute.
This is
a children's book, right?
I mean, it's, I think, designed for tweens. I'm not really sure, but it's really cute. There's, like, pages where it says, like, you know, rub your dinner on this page and document it, steal pens. And
you and Laura have had a huge amount of fun playing with it.
Yeah, like, just cut up the journal, throw the journal from the top of somewhere, you know, very tall, all of these, cover this journal page in office supplies, and it's just very whimsical and brings you back to your childhood, and I really enjoyed doing it, and, I liked it. Again, that's Wreck This Journal by Carrie Smith.
Which I think is a play on the Abby Hoffman Steal This Book. Possibly.
Probably.
So that's Wreck This Journal. Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So my recommendation is a movie called... It was inspired by our discussions of Michael Caine and The Trip in previous weeks. Because, you know, even if you like Michael Caine, there's a lot to wade through in terms of not good stuff to watch. But the movie that I'm going to recommend is a movie called Play Dirty. It's from 1969. It's a war movie. It was sort of billed as a British Dirty Dozen, which I don't think is a super accurate description, but it's close to the mark. It takes place during World War II in North Africa. It's Michael Caine as an untested army officer put in command of a group on a suicide mission across North Africa. His second in command is played by Nigel Davenport in a really arresting role that you will never forget once you see it. An interesting fact is that role was originally to be filled by Richard Harris, who actually showed up on the set and shot for a few days. But when producers told him that he had to cut his hair to look like he was in the army in World War II, he refused and left the set, and he was replaced by Nigel Davenport.
Well, how long was his hair at the time?
I'm not sure. But he missed out on being in a really interesting and great anti-war movie.
Well, someone left the cake out in the rain.
That's
all I have to say.
It is funny and sort of very, very cynical and dark, and has an ending that both comes completely out of left field and yet is entirely appropriate to the movie and you will never forget. So that is 1969's Play Dirty, Kate's recommendation is Wreck This Journal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's it for this week.
I think so.
Dark and Stormy's do right, Fias?
Yeah, very, very tropical.
Yeah, very, it does feel naval. It does feel like grog.
Yeah, exactly.
And as many of our rum drinks do.
A lot of our past couple drinks have all been inspired by the Navy in some way. Mostly British.
You're not going to get me to sing in the Navy.
That's not what I was trying to do,
sure,
but now that
sure
you've said that,
sure,
I will
sure
endeavor
wasn't.
Very hard.
Sure it yep. wasn't. So, we hope you spend some time with us again next week. We've enjoyed spending some time with you. For Kate, I'm Josh.
And for Josh, I'm Kate.
And we will see you again next week on Prefer Not To.
Thank you for listening.